Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. Today I'm joined by Mark Dusick of MarkReviewsMovies.com, which is a great, straightforward title. I love that. I love the name of that site. If you need Mark to review your movies, if you want to see what he says, that is a site to go check, and he's a fabulous writer. Happy to have him on the program. And today we're going to talk about a film that seems to be on everyone's lips right now, especially since it's actually opened everywhere. Like, usually you see the trailers that say, opening everywhere, we're meeting just one art house in Chicago, you know, just like a couple spots here and there. But no, it actually seems like Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master opened pretty much everywhere on September 21st. Like, a lot of the major suburban, you know, multiplexes has gotten this thing. So we're going to be seeing a huge onslaught of opinions on this film, a film that usually, you know, it's like when you have a film like this that is just so enigmatic and so, you know, cerebral, when you have a film that's and also very interpretive, you know, people that tend to see them at the art houses in Chicago, they have kind of an idea of what they're going to expect in the sense that, you know, this is going to be a movie that's not going to, you know, give us all of our story points, just kind of like serve them to us directly. You know, we're going to have to pick apart what's going on. But when you're just having audiences that are going out just for a night at the movies,
it's going to be it's going to be an interesting experience.
I know. Yeah.
It did open wide, and that really shocked me, because I just yesterday when the day it opened, I went online to just try to see it again, and it was everywhere in the city, which shocked me. It's if you know, everyone stayed, which was nice. It was a decent sized crowd for a morning show, and people sat through. I was expecting some walkouts, but nobody walked out.
Well, that's interesting. Is you were expecting walkouts? I had a friend that saw it last night, and he saw it in, I think it was Deer Park. He saw it in, and that was, he said it was the most walkouts he'd ever seen. Although it was like right at the halfway point, it was like people stayed about 90 minutes in, then they decided.
I heard let's leave. Another critic on Twitter was talking about it, and he said that people just got up and were saying their goodbyes to each other about an hour in.
Really?
Which is probably about the same point. I'm wondering what the point was where people are just like,
that's
no,
what I want to know.
I've had enough of this.
I know. Well, and I guess I should say up front, this is, you know, we're going to talk pretty frankly about the film. So
yeah,
it's probably best to see the film before.
Definitely. And
before
I think you'll have a week, correct?
Before, exactly.
People will have a week to see it before we start spoiling everything, but there's no real way to spoil this film, which
exactly
is
exactly what I was gonna say.
I was thinking about it, like, when I reviewed it, I was thinking, like, I don't want to give away too much, and I basically write about the ending, but there's no way that you can tell where that movie is going to go. If you know the mm-hmm. ending to this movie, it still doesn't matter,
because
it's such a just an open question.
Yeah,
at the end, the whole movie is just, I really think the great thing about this is that oh boy, we have to go into a whole bunch of stuff, though, to get to what I think is great about it. But a lot of people are talking about Scientology. I know that you mm-hmm. talked about that last week.
Yeah. Over a few weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
It was after the music box, which
exactly.
I was there, too.
Yes.
I saw you in the very front of the line.
Yeah.
And you were talking with everybody. I was like, well, how early did you get there? I'm just curious.
I think I got
that.
There about 3.5 hours early. Just because, well, because it was when I heard this rumor that Paul Thomas Anderson was going to be there.
Yeah.
And I only show up that early when the person's, because that was when David Lynch showed up for Inland Empire back in 2006. Mm. I was actually outside in the freezing cold. I was like actually like slapping my legs to make sure the blood was still flowing, you know, like circulating. I mean, it was intense, but for Lynch being there, I had to be there. And
yeah.
And for PTA, even though he didn't really say anything, he was kind of hanging out in the back.
Yeah,
he didn't really want to be that present. He was there just to hear the reactions, which I thought was interesting.
And the funny thing about the music box crowd, it's great theater, first off, but
mm-hmm.
you know, that neighborhood has a certain type of person.
Yeah.
Everybody there could have been Paul Thomas Anderson, because they all look like him. They all,
exactly.
They're all dressed the same. And I like,
exactly.
It's just that certain crowd.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, back to the Scientology.
Yeah, yeah.
But
because that's what was on everyone's lips. Months and months going into this, even a year going into this, people were like, oh my God, he's going to make the Scientology movie. He's going to piss off so many people. And it's going to be, you know, and then Tom Cruise, who is a close friend of his, and I think he gave Tom Cruise his best role ever in Magnolia.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be a lot of controversy here. And, you know, a lot of people in Hollywood are going to be calling him on the carpet. So. But what do you think?
It's there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's surely there.
It is surely there.
After I saw the film at the music box, I realized that I had never seen a picture of L. Ron Hubbard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just did a Google search and I typed in L. Ron Hubbard. And one of the first pictures that I saw, like on that first page, was of him posing with a feather quill, which is taken, you know, that's exactly a photograph that Freddie Quell's, Joaquin Phoenix's character, takes of Lancaster Dodd,
that's right.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's the exact same thing. Exact same picture. I'm like, yeah, there's no way you can deny that that's supposed to be L. Ron Hubbard in some shape or form.
And there were certain lines. I mean, you could almost hear in the crowd that we were in just like laughs of recognition when you heard a line that seemed to be kind of going in that direction.
Trillions of years, talking about time and that.
The trillions of years that you can trace back your life to, you know, trillions and trillions of years ago. And trillions is just such an interesting concept.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't really wrap your head around that. But and Hoffman says that at a very key point in the film, a really amazing shot in the movie, actually, in a jail cell.
Yeah.
That just, it's timed perfectly, and that, people laughed.
That shot is fantastic because it gets to the core of the difference between those two characters.
Yeah. You see the dichotomy right there.
Yeah, it's
right there
in front of you where you have, you know, Freddy bashing his cell. I don't want to know what kind of physical pain Joaquin Phoenix had to endure. First off, the hunch, walking around with that hunch the entire time, and then banging his head on that cot. And I don't think, even if that toilet was breakable, I don't think that could not have felt good on his foot.
No.
And then Hoffman is just standing in the other cell. He's just got this really composed pose. He's just kind of arms crossed, feet up, just laying back, relaxed. And it's just right there for you.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Scientology, though, I keep wanting to go back to this.
Sure,
it's not directly about Scientology. That's just the way for everyone to get into this story. It just happens to be very similar to, I'm guessing Dianetics at the time, which was you know, L. Ron Hubbard's post-war kind of,
which came out the same year as Dodd's book in the film.
The Cause.
And we should give just a little, you know, background about just the fact that, you know, Lancaster Dodd, you know, he's the head of this religion. I suppose you can say it's a religion or it's some sort of faith-based group.
It's getting there.
And it's in the midst of creation, and it's a time where a lot of these different faith-based groups were coming up all around the country because there were so many people in that post-war period after World War II, people that just felt so wayward and just so lacking in any sense of direction. People like the Joaquin Phoenix character, who's a war veteran, that really needs some kind of order or structure or inspiration in their lives. And the scene that I think will go down as just one of the best pieces of acting of the last 10 years is, you know, Joaquin Phoenix finally opening up about his life, you know, under the intense interrogation of Hoffman's character, and very much reminds me of, and I think I said this in the past podcast, but about Daniel Day-Lewis and his breakdown and his confession in There'll Be Blood. And I just think that Paul Thomas Anderson, there's just no better director these days. And just, you know, I don't know what he does to get these incredibly brave performances out of these actors and just, you know, making them go so farther than almost any director I can think of right now in America.
Well, he picks great actors too. And I think that's you have to start there. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis and There Will Be Blood is just all three of these performances. There's only one way to describe them, as towering. They're just, they overpower the film that they're in. I think that There Will Be Blood is essentially just Daniel Day-Lewis's movie. I think The Master has more of a better core to it in terms of theme and just and plot too. I like There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably one of my lesser favorites of his, along with Punch Drunk Love. But Daniel Day-Lewis in that just completely sells the movie.
And it was different in Blood because Daniel Day-Lewis really is supposed to be the towering figure in that. And Paul Dano is supposed to be kind of more of an amateurish, you know, I mean, a really kind of just, you know, one of those bugs you want to squish types of people. Whereas in here, Hoffman and Phoenix are such equals that they really do start to blur together. And that's one thing I want to discuss just a little bit. And what I think will show itself even further in subsequent viewings is that as the film progresses and as it goes into its third act, which has some very ambiguous, weird, I mean, that's probably when people started walking out because they're like, I don't know what's going on. But I mean, just certain moments where you see Phoenix, I mean, you can feel the frustration. It's a frustrating third act because Phoenix is just putting himself through these very repetitive, you know, just like, you know, it's, you know, practices. I have to walk from one room, you know, one side of the room to the next and run side of the room to the next. And you know, looking at Amy Adams, and she's like, well, what color are my eyes? You know, they're black. And then we see her eyes turn black. So you know, Anderson right there is telling us, you know, it's okay to question what you're seeing. It's like there's enough in there where you can sort of play with, you know, is this more of a poetic, dreamlike thing that I'm looking at, or is this reality? And so it really starts to blur in that third act.
He does a lot of, not random, but he inserts a lot of subjective point of view shots, mm-hmm. and that's one of them. But it all ties back to his character, like that one scene where he's where Dodd's doing that little song and dance, yes. with for everybody in the room, and he's sitting in the corner. Freddy's sitting in the corner, mm-hmm. and it just will cut. You see his face, and then it cuts back to the group, and all the women are completely naked.
Yeah,
and that is at the heart of what his character is going through. It's not, if you were to just put it down to its basics, a lot of people I think might put it as sex addiction, except that what's funny is he never has sex in the movie.
That's the thing.
Until
the
very end.
Until the end.
And then
we'll talk about that in a minute.
But then you have to wonder, is it really about sex or is it about something else? Something is missing in this guy's life.
Yes.
But the point of that shot where he's just sitting there watching it, he's seeing all these women completely naked dancing around, it's torture for him. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is that he's going through is complete and utter torture, and you can see it on his face. And then having that shot is, you know, it's not gratuitous at all, but, you know, I mean, it is, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know, full-figured women naked, yes. and just dancing around.
And there's a visual coldness to it that's like the eyes wide shut nudity, mm-hmm. in a sense.
Yeah, exactly.
The Kubrick stuff,
yeah, you're not, it's not sexualized in any way, but you, for him it is. Mm-hmm. But, and the same thing with the it's not processing. It's there are different applications. I think he calls.
Sure,
Dodd
I think
them.
Processing is when they're interrogating.
Yeah, yeah. But these different applications, like where he has to do the walk back and forth, and he's Amy Adams' character is asking, "What color are my eyes?" Those are kind of. I think you could look at them almost as brainwashing, but they're not really brainwashing.
Yeah,
or maybe they are.
I think the whole. Yeah, exactly.
That's the main question. Yeah. Is I think of the film as the main question is how. In what way does this program affect Freddy, and is it for the good or is it for the bad? Is it worthwhile? Should he have gone somewhere else? Because he obviously needs help. Mm-hmm. That's clear from the very beginning that he needs some kind of help, but is this the right way to go about it? And this is getting way back to the beginning of this. That's what I think is great about the film, is even if you look at it as a Scientology parallel, it doesn't condemn Scientology. It doesn't condemn the cause, which mm-hmm. is the replacement in here. It just says, here it is. Does it work or doesn't it work? And it's up to you to figure out if it does or not. I'm of the opinion that it does for him. Mm. I don't know what you're thinking. Because that's the very end of the film.
Yes, at the very end of the film. And it's a very ambiguous ending, too.
Yes.
And I think Paul Thomas Anderson has even said in interviews that this just kind of came up when he was editing. Like he didn't really even know how the film was going to end. And
yeah.
you even see in all the teasers they released, all of this deleted footage that's not even in the film. I'm wondering like how much more there is, really.
Well, the Blu-ray is going to be full of stuff, hopefully.
I hope
That'd be nice.
But I really think, you really hit the nail on the head where it's so much about giving into an illusion. I think whenever... You know, I think he wants to parallel a bit falling in love with sort of falling in love with a religion, falling in love with a woman, needing a woman, never, you know, always dreaming about sex, but never having it until the end.
Yeah.
And so, okay, here's a spoilerific moment here. The very last shot, it cuts from him having sex with this woman and then laying next to her to him laying next to this sand woman on the beach.
Which was very important in the opening just to get that sense of whatever kind of sexual frustration he's going through.
Because all of the men, all the war, you know, all the soldiers, they're all, you know, all these people in the Navy, they're very sexually frustrated. And, you know, and so it's such a stupid idea. He just makes this woman in the sand and just starts, you know, using that.
He pantomimes sex with it. And
basically,
then it kind of goes a little too far for him because he's got to go off and take care of business in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Elsewhere. It just doesn't work. And I just felt like that whole... Sandwoman, you can almost make her an idea for this religion too, where it's like you know so much about is God sort of this, you know, giant, you know, sandwoman in a sense where it's sort of like giving into this. It's like how much can I give into this, you know, illusion without really having anything to justify its reality in a sense. Like I felt like that could be sort of a way you could look at it. You know.
Yeah, you could. And the great thing about that is that he's, you know, that's kind of his ideal. Woman in a way, which actually this isn't something I've thought about before, but this is what he's going for right now, is a woman. Once he enters into the world of Dodd, that's what he's going for. He becomes obsessed with Lancaster Dodd and the cause versus whatever it was that he was going through before. And that's where I think the question of is it healthy or not really comes into play, because he's obviously helped, I think, by the end of the film. But was it worth going through all this equal torture? Plus, I mean, he's a lot worse off, I think, during the course of being within the cause. You know, he's violent. He's beating people up who criticize Dodd.
Even as he has his own doubts, and it seems like even as he mm-hmm. becomes more doubtful, then he becomes even more defensive. Which was interesting. Exactly,
yeah.
There's
so much mystery behind these characters, and yet you still have this fantastic idea of exactly what they're doing and what their motives are and everything. And I think a lot of that has to do with Anderson's screenplay, but it's also Hoffman and Phoenix. I mean, they're just so great in this. I mean, they're the two best performances I've seen all year.
Absolutely. I mean, head and shoulders, absolutely.
Because you have Phoenix being completely out there and just, you know, the Americanized method, running around doing whatever he feels like. And Hoffman is so composed, and his diction is so perfect.
And yet he crumbles. You know, it's like Phoenix is that influence on him, where you see that they each have a bit of each other in them, and some people mm-hmm. have said there's some homoerotic, you know, subtext. I don't know if there is too much, but I feel like there is definitely a love story going on between these
yeah.
two men.
Love doesn't need to be sexual. It can
exactly.
still be
it doesn't
fraternal.
Have to be sexual. Exactly.
And beyond
exactly.
that, it's not just that. Phoenix is looking for a fix for his life, and Dodd is looking for purpose to his methods, and they both represent what they're after. Each represents what the other one is after. So that's what I think a lot of people might be thinking the homoerotic undertones or some kind of sexualized love because of the last scene where he sings Slow Boat to China to him, where Dodd sings, I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China
to
Freddie Quill.
Which at that point, and I'll say this, though, the movie's not a good movie to watch at 10 o'clock at night. I think you need a bit of a clear mind, because when he started singing, I was like, no, I've clearly fallen asleep.
Yeah.
I'm clearly hallucinating. He's not singing at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
But
I mean, that's where I think you can get into the idea of love, because that's a love
mm-hmm.
song.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
exactly.
not...
But it also parallels Joaquin Phoenix's, you know, this girl that he was lusting after mm-hmm. earlier. And there's a scene where she also serenades him in kind of this long
yeah.
take. And I thought that was an interesting sort of connection between those two, where I just thought it was more paralleling that idea of, like, love paralleling religion, you know, just finding a purpose, finding a structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's also going back to the visual metaphor, him just going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then finally... in the desert, he just, you know, he's given a limitation. You can only go this far, and he just goes further.
Yeah, he just,
you know, because that was just the perfect illustration of saying, no, I'm done with the structure. I need to go.
Yeah, yeah, and that scene had me on edge, just because it's, you know, speeding across a desert in a motorcycle and a bunch of bumps. That was
in 70mm too, and it's just the most astonishing detail you can get in that. Oh yeah, I mean, I'm sure when it's just projected normally, you can get that.
Yeah,
that
I saw it on a digital projection yesterday, and it still looked. It still looked fantastic.
Yeah,
even without the 70mm, it's just a beautiful film.
Yeah.
You said something and it reminded me of kind of going back to There Will Be Blood, I think, a little bit.
Let's look at some of his other stuff too.
I think if you were to put the two of them, The Master and There Will Be Blood, together, they're great ties, not just because they're both period films and they're more composed and more aesthetically calm than Anderson's other films. I mean, you know, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love are just, the camera is always moving. It's rarely still. It's all over the place. But these two films are more, they're calmer. They're just quieter, except for Johnny Greenwood's score, which just blares at you, which is also, you know, it's like those shouting matches in any of those films.
Sure.
The score just puts you on edge too.
Although I liked that it was a bit more hypnotic as he was getting more entranced in the group. It was a little more, it has a different flow at certain points.
Yeah, it's kind of the reverse of his There Will Be Blood score, which starts off,
which is very much The Shining 2001 going into the which Anderson wanted him to listen to get the inspiration and everything. Yeah,
but both of those are about faith and people's reaction to it. I mean, if you look at the causes, faith, I think The Master is more of a, like, the hopeful cousin to There Will Be Blood. There Will Be Blood, you cannot deny that both Daniel Plainview and Paul Dano's character, is it Eli?
Eli, yes.
They're both charlatans.
Mm-hmm.
They are bar none charlatans. You know, Daniel Plainview promises economic prosperity, and Dano's character promises spiritual prosperity, but they don't care about that. They only care about their best interest.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of people see Lancaster Dodd and The Master as a charlatan, and I think that might be kind of the bias of their people's opinions about Scientology,
expecting the same sort of message too with what the blood set you up for. But he has much more complex, even Magnolia, very complex looks at people of faith. It's not, it's more about the people than about the actual faith.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I don't think Dodd is a charlatan. I think he genuinely believes what he says, even if he's making it up as he goes along. That doesn't mean he doesn't believe it. But Dano's character, it's clear he doesn't believe what he's saying. It's mm-hmm. just a way to toy with people and to get what he wants. And what he wants is just to be seen as, you know, a spiritual figurehead in whatever community he happens to go into. Same thing with Plainview. All he wants is to get enough money to be able to go off and alone and be away from whatever society that he's helped to establish in there.
But in order to do it, he has to have this power over these people, though, too. So
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, you know, that's the...
Yeah, he has to have power over them so he
eats
can
away at both
dismiss
of them.
Them.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the Master is all about joining a community in some way, whether that community is the cause and then whether or not that's good or not. But being able to go into society and be able to be an active member, a worthwhile, positive member to society. And, you know, that's why I think it's more hopeful than There Will Be Blood as a examination of faith or whatever you want to call whatever mm-hmm. those two things are, whatever the cause is. That was something that struck me after I watched There Will Be Blood again for the first time in a long time.
Yeah. I just think it operates against so much of what people have come to expect from certain American films, especially ones that just have a large opening, you know, where it's like we want to be told what to feel at the end. We want to have a certain concrete thing. And this is absolutely the most enigmatic film of his, because even in There'll Be Blood, I mean, it has a huge operatic conclusion. And you're thinking with just the tension in this film that there'll be that. And it's not. It's very much a whole different animal. But I think it's for people who really want to go and just bask in, first of all, just the brilliance of the filmmaking, and then really get to start to think about what he's, you know, operating with here. I think it'll be a very rewarding experience. I just think that even the people that have really praised it, I know Michael Phillips in the Tribune, for example, I mean, I've seen these glowing reviews, and yet even they admit, even the people that love it admit, I still have yet to really, this is still a nut that has to be cracked.
It's one that you have to stew over for a while.
Yeah.
You know, after I saw it at the Music Box, I let it sit for a while before I sat down to write the review. It's just, you have to really let it simmer.
But it's great. And I think with a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson's films, they've really revealed themselves more and more as I've seen them. Like, there's certain films like Hard Eight and Boogie Nights that you just instantly can have an opinion of one way or the other, and I love both. But, I mean, I think that, you know, as with There'll Be Blood, for example, I saw that at midnight. And I mean, I feel like I'd just been bludgeoned by a bowling pin by the end of that.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, it's like you have to have a certain clarity of mind when you're watching.
Oh, yeah,
stuff.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you have to be open to the ending of Magnolia. There's no way you can there's no way you can watch that film and, you know, get, you know, like, what is it, like two hours and 50 minutes of, you know, this, you know, really depressing melodrama. And then suddenly, oh, hey, look, that's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
But talking about the slow boat to China, the bowling pin, because a lot of people don't like the ending scene of There Will Be Blood. I like it. But Anderson embraces the weird.
Oh, yes. I love that he does.
He just has this idea, and he will go with it, and he doesn't care what you might think of it. But, you know, in Magnolia, beyond the ending, you also have the I don't want to talk about the ending of Magnolia yet, because, I mean,
sure.
You really should see it if you haven't yet.
Oh, it's,
and
yeah.
if you have, you know what the ending is.
I think
is.
It's my personal favorite, even though I'd say Blood might be, I don't know. I mean, they're all great in their own way, but Magnolia was the first one that I saw. So
Magnolia, I fell
in
love with.
It's a personal favorite, yeah.
But there's also the montage of them all singing together, the same song for no
reason. Oh, yeah, in Magnolia, yeah.
There's no reason for that scene to be in the film, except that, you know, it's just a weird scene. And it gets to the core. It's right at the center of the film, so everyone's kind of at that tipping point of trying to decide what they're going to do. But to just stop everything in its tracks and just say, we're going to have all these characters sing an Amy Mann song. What?
Yeah. And yet it feels right, because that whole film is like a grand opera, and it's so heightened that the mood that he creates, he creates a mood that allows so much to happen. So much can happen. And I feel like in The Master, that's just like an extension of the ending of Magnolia or There'll Be Blood. The whole thing is weird. The whole thing is just off the wall.
Yeah. But I think there's more. It's structured too. I mean, it's just what's interesting about The Master is that there is a lot of flashing back.
Yeah.
And then there are points where you think it might be flashing forward, but it's not.
Yeah. It's just more subtle. It's just more subtle. It's not as in your face. It's just, you know, so once you think back to it, it's like, well, that was kind of strange. And then you kind of see what he was going for. So, well, we could talk about this forever, though. But
yeah,
I feel like this is a movie that warrants multiple podcasts because there's so many treasures to be found. And it's so exciting to see a filmmaker make a movie that just warrants this much, you know, impassioned discussion from people. And
And there's going to be a lot of it. Because since it opened wide yesterday, everybody's talking about it, and the opinions are really varied. So it's worth it's obviously worth seeing blind just to get an idea, but afterwards do try to seek out some
afterwards
differing
return
opinions.
To us and
get some differing opinions than you know, our glowing.
I urge everyone to give us notes of what you think.
Yeah,
as
exactly.
Well. It's I love talking about this thing. So, Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Thank
I made
you.
The show. I so appreciate it. And for all of Mark's recent reviews, including his review of The Master, visit markreviewsmovies.com. And for all of my recent reviews, visit hollywoodchicago.com and indie-outlook.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.